Hello, Melissa.
Hello, Bill.
This is our weekly The Week in Blog feature at bloggingits.tv. Usually I'm with Matt Lewis. He is off this week, and so we have a special guest. Actually, I'm not even quite sure how to properly pronounce your last name.
It's Clothier.
Clothier. Why don't you tell folks about your blogging background before we get going?
Okay. I blog at my own blog, but that's becoming more of kind of a landing page. I blog there too still. And Right Wing News I blog at, and I write for Pajamas, and I'll probably be starting here with the Daily Caller and, you know, all over.
Daily Caller. Very exciting. So how did you get into blogging in the first place?
A couple years ago, I was at home homeschooling my son, and long story, but anyways, to kind of save my mind, I started blogging, was going to start blogging for my business, and it morphed into politics, and forget it, that was it. I got my first, you know, Glenn Reynolds link and way back in the day, and that did it.
Well, it's great to have you on for the Week in Blog.
It's good to be here.
I'd say the biggest issue of the week in the blogosphere and otherwise is the president's announcement regarding healthcare, that he is urging Congress to have an up or down vote within a, quote, few weeks. I believe the press secretary, Robert Gibbs, said they're hoping to do it by March 18th before the president goes to Indonesia. And obviously part of that is a implicit call to use budget reconciliation and a simple majority vote in the Senate if necessary to pass a series of adjustments to what is currently in the Senate bill. What was the conservative blog reaction to that this week?
Can you say outrage? I mean, people are apoplectic and on the right. You just go down the line of the bloggers. I mean, Eric Erickson, Dan Real, the guys over at Hot Air. It's, you know, you go everywhere. The legal people, anybody who specializes like in legal insurrection or power line guys, anybody who's legally based, everybody for various and sundry reasons are flipping out over this.
Arguing that it's a violation of the law to do this? Or just that they're politically upset that it might work?
I think the argument is that it's unprecedented because they're talking about reconciling a bill that's not law yet. And not a budget bill. And so this is not like tweaking. And Barack Obama himself said that he didn't think that reconciliation was a place for policy decisions to be made. And so now that he's president, he's all happy to have reconciliation to be not just a small policy, by the way, but huge policy that has a big schism within the American populace, too. I mean, this isn't just a political maneuver. This is a deeply divided country we're talking about.
Now, on the left, there's certainly been a lot of talk about the times that Republicans have used reconciliation. There even was a little tweet-off between Rachel Maddow, who ran a long segment criticizing an op-ed from Orrin Hatch, accusing him of flat-out lying about the history of Republicans and reconciliation. Orrin Hatch called it a badge of honor on his Twitter feed, prompting Rachel Maddow to respond to say, I'm not challenging your views, I'm only talking about your use of facts. Is there any on the conservative side saying, yeah, we did use this before, and maybe we shouldn't have done that because it's bad on principle or whatever. Is there any kind of acknowledgement that this is not the first time reconciliation has been used for policy matters?
No, there's definitely recognition that it's been used. But the difference is that it has been used in times for different purposes than what we're talking to right now. I mean, I don't think anybody is questioning whether or not reconciliation's been used in the past. Everybody knows that it has been. But no, there's not even any talk saying that reconciliation should never be used. There's not even, you know, like this is some master principle thing. This is more like it's never been used this way and shouldn't be used this way because of the political reality and the size of the bill, and that it's not used, it's being used to, because it can't be won politically in the normal way legislation is made, it's being used this way. It's the way it's being used, I think, not the fact that it's being used or whether or not it should be used again.
Now, in another angle that I saw on the conservative blogosphere and also with other conservative politicians, trying to make a claim that the president is using it as a judicial appointment of a congressman's brother to get that congressperson to switch his vote. It seemed to me an attempt to create a fresh scandal in the waning days of this debate. Can you explain more about what the argument is?
Well, the president had in a closed door meeting 10 congressmen who voted no on the original bill for various reasons, and one of those guys, his brother, just got, everybody's questioning the timing, just got appointed to, I think, the Supreme Court of Utah, if not mistaken. I don't have it in front of me right now, but, and so it's kind of like it's one more thing that makes the process seem so dirty. I mean, you've already got what's happened in Louisiana and the Cornhusker thing. It's just like it's not. The process has been so sullied, and so this just looks like one more way that influence is being bought.
Is there an actual? I mean, how concrete is this allegation? Did someone actually get someone on record saying, I know that this is being done as a quid pro quo, or is it just some blogger saying, oh, this is happening over here, and this might be happening over here, and let's just speculate that there's a connection between the two?
Well, I haven't, I actually was seeing patients this morning, so I haven't seen the exact latest what's going down. I think at this point it's more an allegation in the allegation stage and being investigated. So I can't speak to the details yet because I haven't investigated it myself yet. But that's just the latest thing that's kind of whizzing about Twitter and the blogosphere right now.
And we should mention that you are highly active on Twitter.
Obsessively so.
Melissa tweets for those who want to follow you. And are you seeing in this healthcare debate? Because there is a very popular conservative Twitter hashtag, TCOT. Is that driving allegations like this one about Scott Matheson? Are you seeing Twitter drive this discussion more than you're seeing conservative blogs actually drive it?
I think it's going back and forth. People are, hashing things out on Twitter and then writing about it, and it's going back and forth. Things seem to be changing moment by moment. One thing that I've noticed is, for example, Jake Tapper's been keeping up with the whip count, seeing how things are going in the House. And so
Jake Tapper, the ABC reporter.
That's right, the ABC reporter.
Also very active on Twitter.
Also very active on Twitter. Yes, he is. And he's got an interesting Twitter feed if you don't follow it. There have been some times when I've thought, is this really him? It's really him. He's got a rather eclectic Twitter feed. It's interesting. But anyway, yeah, so it's going back and forth. This thing is here's the global thing that I see, and I'd be interested in your opinion about it from the left side, Bill, because on the conservative side of the blogosphere, people perceive this bill as changing kind of the fabric of America, being like the first step in a socialized medicine setup, even though
I haven't heard that before.
No, I know you haven't. right? But for the conservatives, this is such a huge deal, and the Republicans, because they feel like once the structure is set up, and I think on the left side, my impression is that people really want this bill passed because they do see it as a first step to get toward what Barack Obama himself has said that he's wanted, and I think many on the left want, which is a single-payer system. And so I think that's why it's so intense, that people feel so passionate about it. And we're talking right now about the procedural wrangling and everything else, but I think that's why there's so much energy on this particular bill.
Well, I think on the left, you actually have right now a lot of division.
Mm-hmm.
You always had division on the left between the diehard single-payer folks and the public option folks and others who are even more compromising than that. You then had a period of time when the public option idea pulled most of the left together, when that seemed to be have a real shot of being in the final bill. And once that has been effectively dropped, you're now seeing, I think, a split between those who are saying, we still want to pass this bill. It's still going to cover 30 million more people. It's still going to make things better than it was. So, and if we don't do it now, we'll never get another bite of this apple for another decade or so. So you're seeing a lot of the bigger organizations. You know, you see MoveOn.org and Healthcare for America Now. They're going to have a, they already had a big call-in day this week. They're having a big rally next week. But in the blogosphere, I think you're still seeing a lot of bruised feelings and disgruntlement that public option isn't in there. You're still seeing a lot of public option activism.
Mm-hmm.
Open Left is still doing a public option whip count. Mm-hmm. There's this letter in the Senate that's up to 34 senators that said we would put public option into reconciliation. So there's still a lot of intensity around that. So when Obama gave his speech earlier this week, I actually found not a lot of enthusiasm about the speech in the blogosphere, a lot of silence. There wasn't a lot of hoorays finally throwing down the gauntlet. There was more, I can't get all that excited about this. I don't see this as being as transformational as I hoped it would be before. I saw John Nichols of The Nation, for example. He blogged. He was even complaining that Obama didn't even use the word reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of made him think that maybe Obama wasn't as committed to it as he might have been. I mentioned Open Left already, still emphasizing public option. Whereas at the New Republic, you saw John Judas herald the speech more as, here's Obama actually throwing down the gauntlet, drawing clear lines in the sand between Democrats and Republicans. You saw Jonathan Chait criticize other progressives for not getting behind the bill and worry that it was going to bring down the bill because they were too obsessed with public option. So there's still a lot of, and I should also mention with Open Left, the Open Left was actually criticizing Organizing for America, because apparently at one of these Organizing for America conference calls, one of the leaders said that pushing for public option would be detrimental at this point, so don't do it, and that rubbed Chris Bowers at Open Left the wrong way. So there's all that fracture going on right now, and so you're not getting the intensity on the right to kill it is bigger than the intensity on the left to get it passed right now. But we'll see how well MoveOn and Healthcare for America. I've always known in past TWIB discussions, the blogosphere is not the left.
Right.
It is a piece of the left. So what disgruntlement you're finding among top bloggers may not be shared by the broader left, and we'll see how that plays out over the next couple weeks.
Well, the interesting thing is that, I don't know how closely you follow Twitter, but Jane Hampshire put out a tweet where she said, there are times when I will join with my colleague across the aisle, and she mentioned me and John Hankey, in order to get something done that we agree on, which is kill this bill. And the reason she feels that way, of course, is because the public option isn't there, and that's very important to her. And in some ways, I can see where she's coming from, because this bill is a huge win for the insurance companies. With an individual mandate, they stand to win. Now, I think that they're making a deal with the devil, because they're hoping that nothing changes from this point. It's a very short-sighted type of hand-holding with the government, which I think is, you're bound to be bit when you get in that kind of a relationship. And so So she's against that for that one, for that's just one of the reasons. And so it's been a very strange process in some ways. Who is agreeing and who's coming together? And I agree with you. On the left, there's a lot of dissension and angst, I think, over this whole thing, because what if it gets passed and it actually ends up being harmful? I mean, here's the thing, Bill. I mean, this bill is very heavy loaded on the front end with increased taxes, but not benefits. And so it's going to be a tough pill, I think.
Well, and I think there is some concern on the left, not so much on the taxes front, but there is concern on the left that, you know, the benefits of reform won't happen right away, and therefore there'll be all this hullabaloo upon passage, then not much will change immediately, and that could then hurt Democrats, you know, in 2010 and 2012. You have a counter-argument from folks like Jonathan Cohen, also in the Republic, saying, look, there actually are a number of things in this bill, not the bigger reforms, but there are some smaller reforms that do happen earlier, and there are things that Congress people could do to tout them right away to say, look, the change is beginning and better stuff is going to be around the corner. You've also seen Jonathan Chait make the argument saying, you know, yes, the revenue raising happens earlier, but a lot of the savings, the benefits are pushed off to some degree, but so are the savings. So it's not like you're just taking everyone's money out of their pocket and, you know, dumping it into a hole. The whole thing's a phase in.
Right.
And it's tough to explain that politically, particularly when there's so much, you know, hoopla around its passage. So that's definitely something that some people on the left are concerned about, I think, in a different way than folks on the right are concerned about.
Do you honestly think, though? I mean, if I were a congressman looking at re-election in 2010, this bill is kind of a stinker for them. And one of the things that I've said, and I don't know, you'll have to correct me if I'm going off on a topic that isn't applicable in this format, but I've wondered if, because the chief beneficiary of this bill seems to be President Obama, and
that's only true if the bill ends up being popular. He's just as much a political risk than any congressperson is.
Well, that's true in the longer term, but for right now, he can say he has a win. But it seems to me to come at the expense or on the backs of a lot of congresspeople who will not be reelected because of it, even if it turns out to be better legislatively and personally for the American people than we think, or I think. You probably are thinking it's going to be a good thing, but
I mean, most Democrats, you know, I think pre-Scott Brown were going on the lesson of 94, which is even if the process is making some people skittish, what tends to happen is a lot of Americans like the concept of healthcare reform in concept. Once you get in the middle of the process and the proposals take flack, that pushes people's skeptic buttons, and they start to pull back from it. And what happened in the mid-90s was Democrats said, whoa, this is becoming unpopular, let's jump ship and not have Bill Clinton drag us down. But what happened, Democrats then lost, and you can interpret why that was for different reasons, but one argument is by failing to govern, by failing to actually follow through on their promises, they gave no reason to keep them around, and it's the most right-leaning Democrats that lost those races, not the most liberal ones. They're the ones who are the most vulnerable. So it seemed that there was going to be a sense of, you know, no matter what the snapshot of the poll says, you're going to be better off acting than not acting. You've definitely seen a pullback amongst a lot of right-leaning Democrats in the past few weeks, challenging that notion, but the president is definitely going out there saying to folks, you know, and even more so than in 94, because most of these guys have voted for the bill at this point, voted for some version of the bill. So you already got it on your record.
Right.
You might as well follow through and actually put it in law so we can start talking about the reforms that get phased in, and we can pat ourselves on the back for that. Otherwise, you're going to get all the baggage and none of none of the glory. And what we don't know, and it's all speculation until you pass it. I heard Bill Clinton make this argument at Netroots Nation last year. His argument was, on the day you pass it, the poll numbers go up because you did something, because you actually got through the wash and morass and you accomplished something. But no one knows if that's true until you do it. And it's all argumentation until that point.
And I would say Bill Clinton is wrong. That is a very interesting argument, and people like to make it. I think with the national mood right now, feeling that, you know, there's this overwhelming feeling that I'm not quite sure the people in D.C., because D.C.'s booming, of course. It's, you know, the Democrats are in charge. D.C.'s doing great. But across the country, people are like, this feels like a big spending bill. And I'm not talking about the reality of the elements of the legislation. I'm saying what it feels like. And if this passes, I think it's going to really outrage the American people.
Well, I mean, you right now you see a disconnect in the polling between people not liking the overall bill. Do you like the bill? People say no. When you talk about the individual elements of the bill, they tend to poll better.
Right.
And there's a blog post that I just put up today. You know, one of the things that I would argue has been lost in this is that the bill is scored as a deficit cut, but a lot of these right-leaning Democrats are still talking about it as if it is costly. So you don't have a unified Democratic Party communicating the message that this is actually going to save people money, and therefore a lot of people think it's not going to save them money, so they get upset about it. So on the day you pass it, presuming you do pass it, if you have a range of Democrats making the argument collectively that it's going to be a cost saver, does that change the polling? Does that change people's perceptions? I don't know yet, but that's one thing that could possibly change the dynamic from where it is today to where it could be 2 weeks from now.
I'm just laughing because it's delusional. But okay, I mean, it's just like I'm thinking this is not how an average. Now I'm out here in Texas, and I'm like, this is not how.
Hey, I live in Scott Brown country. I'll let you know.
Yes, I know you are. But I this is not how the American people think. That's a very DC way of thinking about it. Well, once it passes, and they see that, you know, they're not going to see the cuts. They're going to see another big government, what they hear and feel. And I'm not saying it's rational, but people are not rational. People make decisions based on the emotion of things. And they're looking around at the jobs, and they're looking around at the unemployment rate. And this feels like a big, another big government program. It doesn't matter what the facts don't matter at this point is what I'm saying. And the Democrats are...
You may well be right, but I think it's an untested proposition. I mean, and I agree with you that people base things more on emotions and feelings of things than no one cracks open 100-page briefing books on stuff because they don't have the time to do so. But it is possible you could change people's feeling about the bill if there is a coordinated communications effort, which there can't be while the Democratic Party is divided. You can't have any coordination while you're in the middle of arguing with yourself. And that only changes the day you pass the bill because everyone's on the same page.
Right. Well, and the thing is, it is a 2,000 and change page. It's not like it's meant to be simple or simple to understand. And that makes it difficult to communicate a message, too, in some respects, because the bill is all over the road, and so people are communicating all over the road. And
well, to shift topics, if I may. Mm-hmm. One thing that was simpler, I'd say, I think, for Democrats to communicate around this week was the Jim Bunning obstruction of the unemployment insurance extension.
Mm-hmm.
We had one guy, one person to focus on, a very clear issue. A lot of people are out of work, can't get unemployment benefits. And you saw a lot of rallying to put pressure on him. You know, the Democratic Party was unified. The blogosphere was unified. You had Tim Fernholz at the American Prospect talking about this as here's why we need to change the Senate rules. If one guy can subvert the majority will and put jobless people at risk, what better argument you could make? Digby made an argument that this is a perfect example of, you know, sort of Tea Party run amok, that they dismissed the entire concept of unemployment insurance and they have disrespect for the jobless. You had Kevin Mother Jones saying, I didn't agree with liberals that Republicans were this nihilistic when it comes to governing, but this changed my view. How could someone take this argument to such an extreme? In the conservative, I read in Politico that a lot of Republicans actually were unhappy with Jim Bunning because he stepped on the healthcare message and gave Democrats a rallying point. Was that shared in conservative blog circles? Was there anger with Bunning that he did this, or was there excitement that he was standing up to the Big Spang Democrats?
No, I think the blogosphere was more kind of like, go, Jim, go. It was kind of, that whole episode was to me very amusing because I always, and this is, I find it very enjoyable to see the left squawk in such unison. And so everybody was outraged and upset. And I'm like, this is a $15 billion bill. It was basically a gutted piece of nothing. And the Democrats knew it. This isn't like the miracle bill. And they were having a fit over it. And he was just saying, this is $15 billion. And we can't, you know, the Senate is not following, the Congress is not following its own PAYGO rules, which the president just signed into law. And he was making a fight on principle. And I think probably it got the leftist base all riled up, and I think it probably got the conservative base all riled up, and I think nobody else cared.
I think it's fair to say that any party is at risk with an ideological extreme pulling folks away from the proverbial center. And it's certainly, you see conservatives saying all the time, don't pass this health care bill because you'll lose the center because it's this big, ginormous bill. I would think there would be some blogger out there would say, yeah, whatever merits this argument has, it doesn't look good for you to be seen as opposing unemployment insurance in the middle of an extremely deep recession. To go back to your earlier point, that's an emotional argument. whatever factual argument you might make about, you know, budgets and deficits and whatnot, that really hits you in the gut when you're cutting someone off who needs unemployment insurance. There is no concern, at least about the optics of that.
Well, the thing is, there's I see the optics of that. There's no question. And the left loves, it's like, it fills them with glee to paint the right as like meanies. And so, see, Bunning's being mean. See, Republicans are mean, you know. I think that the bigger issue, and I don't know how I don't know how this is pulled. Has any polling been done on this?
I haven't seen any. I mean, it's probably hard. The whole debate lasts, I think, you know, Thursday night to Tuesday night. So it's a pretty short window to get an accurate poll sample done, I'd imagine.
See, that's why I think nobody cares. I mean, that's my sense. I think that what it sent a message to as far as because here's the thing to keep in mind, Bill. The center and the independents have left Barack Obama. They have left they elected this man because they thought of this, he was going to bring fiscal responsibility. I mean, they thought he was going to be more fiscally responsible than George Bush. I think they were delusional, but that's what they thought. And so when the stimulus bill has passed and then the TARP thing, of course, that was under Bush, but, you know, Democratic Congress. And then
I believe Newt Gingrich would say it's the Bush-Obama bailout.
Exactly. And so I'd agree with that. And so then you move along. Something like this just feels like one more thing. Like, oh, it's just $15 billion. What do we care what we need to pass? It's like funny money to Congress. So in the bigger scope of things, the American people are sick to death of this kind of spending, even for unemployment benefits. And so I think that they're like, okay, if you're going to do something, pay for it and explain to us why. And they're just,
I mean, do you
been
think
that
the, you know, I think there were what, about 20 plus Republicans that voted for it. Do you think that they're out of touch with the American public? If they, if everyone is so angry with the spending, they don't even want unemployment insurance. These Republicans are missing the boat.
No. That's what I wrote about this. No, because some of the people on Twitter and whatever were getting their panties in a bunch about Scott Brown voting you know, to get it out of a committee or whatever, and then having it come and then voting on it again. And I'm like, okay, this isn't easy. First of all, it's not that big of a deal. It's only $15 billion, and I say only in the scheme of life. It's not going to do much, but it gives him political cover back home, and it makes him look more centrist. And that's there are senators that are going to do it. There's senators from conservative states who are going to, this would be a bad thing for them, and everybody wins. This is one of those things where, woohoo, everybody feels better.
So you've not turned on Scott Brown.
No, I haven't. He's from Massachusetts.
Every conservative has an attitude, from what I understand.
Well, no, you're right. And I got a lot of pushback from my readers because of that. I got an email. He's betrayed me. I sent him money. You know, we're supposed to be fiscally conservative, da-da-da-da-da. I mean, I don't think anybody expected him to be socially conservative. Nobody expects that. But I think that they do expect him to be fiscally conservative, and even the small bill, which I knew why he did it, so it didn't bother me. But for people who are more idealistic and sick to death of D.C., it bothered them.
We also had this week the tinge of scandal on the Democratic side. You had Charlie Rangel got admonished by the Ethics Committee, which prompted him to temporarily relinquish his chairmanship of the Ways and Means Committee, which, if folks don't know, is a very powerful committee. It deals with all the tax law. And Rangel had been in Congress such a long time, he worked his way up to that. That was not something he was very keen to do. And there is a maybe scandal with Congressman Eric Massa. He's a freshman congressman. Said he wasn't going to run again. He's saying it's for health problems. There are some allegations of sexual harassment, which he is flatly denying. I remember in doing a blogging heads with Con Carroll from Heritage Foundation years ago when some of the Rangel stuff first popped up, and he was, you know, as giddy as a schoolgirl about it. And you know, my reaction was, you know, if Rangel's got to go, Rangel's got to go. I don't really care. You know, if you got the goods on him, fine. You know, cut him loose. And I think in the liberal blogosphere this week, I saw it on Daily Kos, I saw on MyDD saying Rangel's stepping down. Good, I don't need to, you know, stick my neck out for this guy if he was playing close to the line. What's the conservative blog reaction to all this?
Well, of course he should go. This is not even a question. It's like bye bye. But this stuff gets dragged out, you know, especially if it's a Democrat, it seems. And,
Is there an attempt now in the conservative blogosphere to extrapolate this into something larger beyond those two individuals?
Well, I think the deal is in the bigger scheme, Bill, is the promises that, you know, Nancy Pelosi made that she was going to drain the swamp. Well, guess what? The swamp is still a pit. And there's just this kind of the lack of transparency. It's just one more thing where people are going,
DC. But if he steps down, is that not the proper reaction? You know, once the Ethics Committee does its investigation, he gets admonished, he steps down. Is that not the proper order of things?
Of course it's the proper order of things. It should have happened a couple of years ago. I mean, this thing has been building, like you said, for a long time. And but like you also said, he's got a lot of power there. And he hasn't stepped down yet. He is just taking a break, right? So he hasn't really admitted that he's done anything wrong.
The admonishment is one, it's an admonishment. That in and of itself is certainly not the stiffest conclusion the Ethics Committee can make, but that's only was about a one issue of the many lingering issues that have been right. Talked about with him. So he could have made an argument to say, hey, I haven't been really, you know, nailed to the wall here. I shouldn't have to step down.
Right.
I think that's why he didn't step in earlier, because there's still a lot of issues that have been allegations that have not been fully investigated and conclusions been drawn. But he seemed to, under pressure from Pelosi, Democrats say, look, we just don't need the distraction right now. You know, why don't you take this break until all these other issues get fully sorted out? And if you come out clean, you come out clean. Great, we'll bring you back.
Mm-hmm. Again, I'm laughing because if the
shoe isn't that a better way to handle it than the way Republicans defended Tom DeLay for months and months and months, even after he was indicted? Isn't that a much worse way to approach it?
Are you talking about the grand jury indictment here in Texas?
The indictment happened, you'd think you'd say, even if you think you're been indicted unfairly, you'd say, I'm going to step back and let the process play out. And but Tom DeLay didn't do that until months and months after the indictment. And most Republicans rallied around him.
And do you know why they rallied around him? They rallied around
He's a very powerful guy.
Well, in Texas, he was. Now he's on Dancing in the Stars, but whatever. the deal here was that he was being railroaded, and then nothing came of it. The guy who was trying to indict him had to basically pick a grand jury over and over and over and over again to finally get one to do what it was a political hit job. And so that's why he was getting being defended. And the same cannot be said in Charlie Rangel's case. It's apples and oranges. And now, I don't know how many people were crying, baby salty tears over DeLay leaving. You know, he made plenty of enemies on his own side, I think, before he, stepped down and left. But there was a reason he was being defended. And nothing nothing ended up coming of it.
He hasn't been found guilty yet, but I don't believe the case has been closed.
Oh, okay. Well.
I mean, that's just a factual observation.
Yeah, right. Okay. With the implication that he really is guilty, but...
He might well be guilty.
Okay. Nice. Well, so is your view that Charlie Rangel's being railroaded here?
I am perfectly happy to have Charlie Rangel go through the legal process. And if he's found guilty, he's found guilty. If he's not, he's not. I have no need to stick my neck out for him and accuse him of being subject to a political hit job when there are some legitimate allegations, and I'm happy to see them be investigated.
Okay, everybody out there who's listening, that means that, yes, he's guilty. That's an awful lot of parsing.
Anywho. Final topic. You did see, you've seen in the liberal blogosphere a hunger to challenge right-leaning Democrats in primaries, saying that they are not properly representing their constituents. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of blogosphere focus on Senator Blanche Lincoln after she was sort of wishy-washy on the public option for a while. There was a time where she sounded like she'd be for it, but she's now been very adamantly against it. I think since that point, people have tried to organize around an opponent for her, and they got one this week in Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter, and you had immediately Fire Dog Lake and Down with Tyranny, two blogs that have been regularly raising money online for progressive candidates, in addition to bigger online organizations like Move On and Democracy for America. And instantaneously, he's been able to raise money nationwide. I think it's over $1 million in the first week. Just from showing up and saying, I'm going to run against Blanche Lincoln. Whether or not he's got a viable chance of knocking her off, it's interesting from a blogosphere perspective that there's still that infrastructure is still there to rally around individual candidates and raise money for them nationwide. I mean, it's not something I think you can replicate, 100 times over, but there are certain candidates that can catch a wave and draw a lot of financial support and be more viable than they might have otherwise have been. And you also saw on Daily Kos today, Blanche Lincoln has her first ad out. I think there's some question how Blanche Lincoln might react to this. Would she move left to squeeze him out, or would she plant her flag on the right and pronounce her, ideological independence, if you will? And that's what she did. She attacked public option. She attacked the climate bill. And saying she doesn't represent the Democratic Party, she represents the good people of Arkansas. So those battle lines have been drawn. is there any conservative blog reaction to this, or are they more focused on their own primary favorites like Marco Rubio in Florida.
Well, I think there's been some attention paid to it. You know, as a right-side blogger myself, this is good news. Let the Democrats beat each other up and spend a lot of money. I wholeheartedly support that.
But this beating each other up is happening on the right, too. There are conservatives looking to have those same sort of primary challenges.
Absolutely. And I'm all for that, too, by the way. And the reason why I'm all for that is because...
Blood on the floor everywhere.
Exactly. There's times when blood needs to be spilt. Now's the time. And the reason for that is because I think that the sense among the people is that there's like this D.C. culture that's just not reflective of the culture from wherever. What I heard somebody say, and I think is accurate on both sides, this is an anti-incumbent thing. This is an anti-D.C. thing. It's not necessarily specifically ideological. It's more cultural. But the D.C. people seem to be coming back to their home states and representing D.C. values to the states, trying to sell D.C. values, rather than going, hearing their people and going to D.C. and representing their people. Now, in Blanche Lincoln's case, what's his name?
Halter.
Yeah. I read this yesterday, and I can't remember where now, but basically he's raised all this money on the left, but when he's been pressed about how he feels about, like, the public option and everything, he's been playing kind of footsie. And so I think maybe that they're sending money kind of...
You think they're getting played?
Yes, I think they're getting... Because he knows, if he's got any sense at all, he can't get elected as a far-left guy in that seat. It's not going to happen.
Well, you know, I think Arkansas is a bit of a, you know, funny state ideologically. Mm-hmm. It's a state that went from Bill Clinton to Mike Huckabee, you know, in a matter of years.
Yeah, but they're not so different.
Well, there's a strain, I think, of economic populism, you know, through both mm-hmm. of them.
Right.
And the question is, and I think Bill Halter is trying to run as a populist candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And you could try to argue... you could try to frame public option as a populist issue. You could try to argue it as an evil big government issue. And the ad that Blanche Lincoln ran was trying to separate herself from Washington, say, I'm there standing mm-hmm. up against all this Washington big government ridiculousness. Mm-hmm. And Bill Halter is going to try to embrace a populist mantle and say that Blanche Lincoln's too close to the special interest, I suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas in your state, in the Texas primary, you had... You know, Rick Perry being strictly anti-Washington and Caleb Hutchinson having no capacity to distance herself from Washington because she's been there for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, and that result seemed to be a fait accompli. So I don't know if it's clear to me. I mean, I take your point that Halter is not being crystal clear on public option. And you may well be right that, I mean, I think one of the things that frustrate a lot of liberal bloggers that have backed candidates in redder parts of the country and have been a lot, there's been a lot of disappointment mm-hmm. of the way they voted once they get in office after taking money from Netroots folks. So that it might be a repeat performance with Halter. I have no idea. But I do want, it's still, jury's out, I guess, on how much to the left Halter is going to run vis-a-vis Lincoln. It's clear Lincoln is clearly going to attack Halter as a liberal and position herself as a conservative, and we'll see if that can get her out of the Democratic primary in Arkansas. I really don't know.
Well, you know, I'm going to make a bold prediction here, Bill. I'm going to say that this dude, whoever he is, he could, you know, unless he is a nutter, may well beat her in the primary. But
on anti-incumbent grounds?
Oh, on anti-incumbent grounds, absolutely. And then in the general, he'll lose. Because everybody's going to go, ooh, Republican. That's what's going to happen. So.
Well, if I may make my own non-prediction.
Okay.
I think there's so much fluidity in Washington right now. There's mm-hmm. so much uncertain what's going to get passed and what's the reaction to what gets passed mm-hmm. and what the job situation is going to be mm-hmm. and what the perception of the job situation is going to be by November, I think it's impossible to predict which way a wave might go. It's way too uncertain to plant your flag one way or the other and say this is definitely going to happen. I think there are a lot of times when like things have been baked in the cake to a degree and you can map things out. I don't think very much is baked right now. So I would hold off on being too absolutist at this point.
Well, you know, and here's the thing. Everybody listening to this should feel good because I'm always wrong. I make these predictions and I'm kind of like the Dick Morris of the blogosphere because I make these predictions and I'm
as
wrong.
As loyal blogging heads folks know, I predicted that Martha Coakley would win by 10 points. So,
oh, you did
know,
you?
I did. I've been properly shamed as well.
Well, the thing is, as far as Martha Coakley goes, I picked her by 3. So, see, that just tells you how wrong I am. So,
well,
and I'm glad I was wrong. Yeah. Well, that's true. Actually, that is true. Bill, I at least predicted. I knew that people were asking me about this whole race here in Texas. And I was like, there's, you know, what I wasn't sure about is if Perry would get over the 50% hump and there would need to be a runoff. But I knew he was going to win. It was just a matter of, are we going to have to go through the trouble of having a runoff? And I figured if we did, he'd win that too. I mean, but a blind man could have seen that here. So it doesn't make me a genius, I don't think. Although some people saying that Deborah Medina, she was going to, you know, I was like, I don't know what these people are smoking. It is not happening. She basically got the Ron Paul vote is what happened. And her people are Ron Paul people.
So does the Democrat have a shot there at all?
Oh, yes. A Democrat has a shot here in Texas, for
sure.
So
Bill White will give Perry a run?
I think he might. He's very well known and well liked here in Houston, and because of his handling of Hurricane Katrina, because really Houston took care of the New Orleans people after all that happened for a couple of years, and then we got Hurricane Ike and Hurricane Rita, well, Hurricane Rita and then Hurricane Ike, and so he was put under a lot of pressure, and so he is well respected for the work that he did with all that, but he's got a lot of other things that will tick general Texans off, which is his stance on cap and trade. And so that's just not going to fly. So if he can mitigate against that, he'll do fairly well. His problem at this point is name recognition in the rest of the state.
Well, I don't want to get us on a whole cap and trade tangent.
Yeah.
Probably should wrap things up. But I would note there's been a lot of activity in Washington around a new climate bill that John Kerry and Joe Lieberman, Lindsey Graham, tripartisan effort that would be a hybrid bill of sorts where the cap and trade piece would only apply to the utility sector and it would not apply to the oil sector. Mm-hmm. And there would be a carbon tax on motor fuels instead, but not a cap on emissions. And it seems like that their strategy is try to line up 60 senators around that even before they introduce the legislative language. Mm-hmm. And if that happened, and if the bill actually got passed, one, it would be a pretty stunning legislative achievement, I think, despite everything that's happened in the past year. But I wonder how that might roil the Texas race if there is a clear distinction on global warming between White and Perry.
Right. Well, and right now, there is just boiling, fuming rage at Lindsey Graham. He just is like, you know, just as the Republicans seem to be making the strides, a guy like Lindsey Graham tries to, you know, help the opposition out is how it's viewed. You know.
Well, I think that's fascinating to me, and I've argued this point with, you know, most liberals would say every Republican, it's a unified obstructionist party, there's no point talking to them while you're wasting your time. And while I agree with that, you know, 95%, but I've also noted on every significant issue, there has always been at least one Republican that has talked. And it's never been the same. It's like it's always Olympia Snow. It's like there's a group of Republicans that still want to be in the mix but don't want to take all the heat. And they've shared the burden. Well, you'll do this one,
right?
And I'll do this one.
Graham's taking
the heat on global warming.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think you're wrong about that at all. I definitely get the feeling with all this is that they're, and that's why with this jobs bill, I think that, you know, that's why Scott Brown was picked to be the go-to guy on it. He's new. He's young. Everybody loves him. It's not going to cost him a lot. And so he gets sent out as a little sacrificial baby lamb. And then you're right. The next guy gets sent out to – I think you're exactly right. You've nailed it. I think that's exactly what's happening.
We agree.
We agree. I think we should stop right there.
Well, it's been great to have you on.
It's been good to talk to you, too. I was kind of laughing at the producer guy who was helping us set this up. I said, well, the last interaction I had with Bill was on Twitter fighting about articles and polling on healthcare. So this should be interesting.
Well, I will see you on Twitter. I hope to see you back on the Week in Blog very soon.
Okay, great. Yeah, me too. Thank you.
Take
it's been
care.
Fun. You too. Bye.